thanks to everybody for coming. I hope that your feet don't get too tired. We have a really special evening tonight. It's the greatest collection of pundit talent since Walter Lippmann dined alone. What we're going to try to avoid is that strange phenomenon where everything's been said, but not everyone has said it. And we have the panel to do that this time, really give you a lot of different angles of vision on the two presumptive nominees, John McCain and Barack Obama. As I introduce the panelists, I'm not going to include very many of any of their TV affiliations, because you basically cannot turn on a television nowadays without seeing at least somebody on the panel on TV 24/7. So I won't take up a lot of time specifying which shows everybody appears on. But from my far right to moving this way, first panelist is David Brooks, who since 2003 has been an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, as I think all of you know. He's also the author of two terrific and fun books, Bobo's in Paradise and On Paradise Drive, and is working on a third that some of you might have heard about earlier today. Next to David is Jim Wallace, who is the founder of the Sojourners Community, which for 30 years now has been a very important Christian ministry in this country, focused on social justice issues and world peace. And he's also the editor-in-chief of Sojourners magazine and a leading theological figure in our country. Next to Jim is Arianna Huffington, who is the author of 12 books, writes a syndicated column, but I think is now best known as the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the now highly successful Huffington Post. And next to Arianna is Stuart Rothenberg. For those of us who cover politics, Stuart's work is indispensable in handicapping the horse race in at the presidential level and the state and local level as well. And the Rothenberg political report is something that I would encourage you guys to tune into if you haven't already. Next to Stuart is Amy Goodman, who is principal host of a program on public radio and television called Democracy Now. It's on more than 700 radio stations alone. I mentioned the television, but on radio alone, you're on more than 700, I thought. Anyway, maybe I got that slightly off. And she's the author of three books, the most recent one, Standing Up to the Madness, and she keeps us all honest from a liberal, progressive perspective. And next to Amy is Jonathan Capehart. And Jonathan is an editorial writer for The Washington Post. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the New York Daily News, where the editorial page won a Pulitzer Prize in 1999. And in between, he helped Mike Bloomberg get elected mayor of New York and was an advisor to him. So that's our panel. Start off doing is I'm going to ask each of them a specific question, and then after we get through that round and you get a little familiar with each of them, then we're going to ask more questions of the panel as a whole. But if somebody says something, even in this portion of the program, that you really want to leap in on and take issue with, feel free to do it. So I want to among the panelists. We're not at the audience. We're not at the audience part of the program yet. So I want to start with David. And David, you've known John McCain for a long time. And you say some nice things about him in your column once in a while, but you haven't really told us why you think be a president. Maybe we missed the mic. You haven't really told us why you think he would be a good president of the United States.
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here on this panel, which was obviously produced by Cecil B. DeMille. There are 900 of us. Maybe we should be the audience and you guys should be the panel. And the second thing to be said is we don't endorse.
I know that.
So we coyly write so it's obvious who we think should be president without endorsing. My views of McCain are essentially this. First, I do think he is a great man. I think he's humble in the ways a politician is capable of being humble. When you call politicians and ask them what happened in a committee hearing or a back room, often senators will lie to you flat out. If McCain tells me something happened in a back room, I know it's the truth. And I can put it in the paper with complete confidence that he's told me the truth. That's been tested time and time again. The third thing to be said is that you can talk with him and you can sit with him hour upon hour, and he can talk about just about anything, and he has, over the past 10 years, proven to be quite a good legislative craftsman. A lot of the most complicated pieces of legislation he's in the middle of. The final thing to be said about him, before I get to some drawbacks, is that if you go to his office, most senators have their office in the corner of their suites. McCain has his office in the middle of the suite. And the staff is constantly running through, and that's because he is incapable of sitting down. He definitely has the energy to be president. The drawbacks are that he is the antibody to organization. And he is a guy who's been flying by the seat of his pants since he was a pilot. And the White House is not like taking off from the aircraft carrier. It's running the aircraft carrier. And so I think his strengths are his wisdom, his maturity, his personal sense of honor. He's someone I made a joke today which rubbed people the wrong way, which is that he has a pre-Christian sense of morality, and I said that's because he's older than Christ, actually. but it's a classical stoical sense of honor, a pre-Christian morality, and he's driven by that moral sensibility. If he sees something that he thinks is morally disreputable, he will go at that thing. But whether he can actually run a vast organization in a very organized way, that's somebody, even somebody like myself, who admires him greatly, has worries about.
Let me just quickly follow up. You know, he was quoted as saying at one point, I'm computer illiterate. Do you think that matters for a president in the 21st century?
he's in a funny way. One of the things he and Obama share is they're neither are 60s people. He was away for the 60s. Obama was too young for the 60s. He is someone who spends his days reading books. You can talk to him about biographies. He loves short stories. He generally loves novels and movies where the hero fights a brave fight and then dies in the end. And I try to tell him sometimes, you know, you don't have to lose just to fulfill your for whom the bell tolls fantasy. But is he in touch with everything about America? Frankly, no. And I think this is a unique feature of this race. I don't think we've ever had two candidates who have never had what you might call a mainstream American experience. McCain comes from military aristocracy. Obama has a very unique experience, but it's not the typical suburban upbringing experience. And I think in some ways both of them, but in particular McCain, because he is in some ways an archaic figure, they are not in touch with a lot of normal things that people go through. And for McCain, that includes Facebook, which you okay. can decide if that's good or bad. But yeah. I don't
Jim, think... Jim, you've known Barack Obama for a while. You can tell us how long. How do you think his faith would affect his presidency?
His faith?
Yeah.
I've known Barack for about 10 years. He was a lowly state senator. And we used to have three kinds of conversations at the beginning. One was about his faith. We were progressive in our faith, and the religious right was kind of in, and we were kind of out at that time. So we talked about how it felt to be. We just thought that, capital gains tax cuts and the war in Iraq were not the first things Jesus would have done. I don't know, it was kind of a strange idea. So we talked about that. We talked about how even back then he said left and right are straitjackets preventing us from solving problems. And he wanted to get beyond those categories. Even then he was talking about that. Then we were both older fathers with new kids, so we talk about parenting all the time. Today he gave his big faith-based address. I was traveling, so I just have read it. And, the pundits are saying he's reaching out to white evangelicals, and he is. But that's not just why he did it. I mean, it's because of who he is. He was an organizer in the South Side of Chicago, working with churches and faith-based organizations, and he knows the contribution civil society makes to solving issues like poverty and how churches and mosques and synagogues especially can play a critical role. So I think this is part of who he is. Yet he gave a speech. His kind of signature speech was at our conference years ago about how he chastised the left for often wanting to banish religion from public life. And he said that was a mistake, but you have to do it in a way that respects pluralism, diversity, and democracy, how Dr. King did it best with the Bible on one hand, Constitution on the other hand. There's a way to do this well that is respectful of all of our diversity. I think he wants to do it that way. He doesn't want to be a theologian in chief. He wants to be somebody who's shaped by his faith. But the most important thing about a candidate is not their doctrine or denomination. It's their moral compass. Now, what's their moral compass? And for him, his faith helps shape his moral compass. But he'd be the first to say that you don't need to be a religious person to be president of the United States. He would strongly object to that. But it will shape his leadership, particularly on issues like social justice and poverty and criminal justice and war and peace. And I think he's kind of Lincoln-esque in this sense. I think religion either leads to an easy certainty or a deeper reflection. And Lincoln said we should never claim God's on our side. We should worry if we're on God's side. So there's a humility about his sense of religion, which I think is more Lincoln-esque than maybe what we've seen for the last few years.
He resigned from Trinity Church, and he's looking for a new church. Where do you think he'll go?
Probably no place before the election. Unless that pastor wants all his sermons on YouTube every Sunday. I think he'll probably wait a while. I suspect he'll go to a church that really has a strong combination of personal faith, which he has, and social justice. And for him, those two are pretty inseparable. But, it's a part of his life. It's he wasn't, a lot of people say, oh, he's religious because he's black. All black people are religious. No, he was from an agnostic background. He had a conversion experience, went down the aisle one Sunday in the South Side. And the nice thing about Barack, faith doesn't erase doubt, which means he's a human being. He still has doubts about things, and his faith embraces hopes and doubts and all the rest. But he'll find somewhere, he will find a church, I'm sure. And there's already applications, I think, being sent to him from pastors in Washington, D.C.
Okay, Arianna, you have known John McCain since at least the early 90s, right? Maybe even earlier. And you were very friendly with him at least through the 2000 election when he keynoted your counter-convention at the L.A. Democratic Convention that year. How did he change? Or did you change in your perception of him?
No, I think he really did change. And I was very saddened by the change, because even though there were always things with which I disagreed with McCain, I saw him as a real leader, a real reformer. In 2000, when I organized shadow conventions in Philadelphia, where the Republican convention was, and in Los Angeles, where the Democratic convention was, to address issues neither political party was addressing, issues of poverty. Jim and I worked on that together, campaign finance reform and the failed war on drugs. Jim and I were really surprised when John McCain accepted our invitation to keynote the Philadelphia convention. He called me the day before and he said, George Bush personally called me and asked me not to do it, but I'm going to do it. And that was John McCain. And that was something for which I will always be grateful. And that's why his fall to who he has become now is a Shakespearean fall. It's not a Mitt Romney flip-flopping. It's not a political hack who says one thing one day and another thing another. That is a man who has abandoned every sacred principle in the quest for the presidency, starting with his position on immigration. He now has said he would not be voting for his own bill. He had said that he would not be voting for George Bush's tax cuts because he could not do it in good conscience. This was a politician who talked in terms of conscience, as David said, old-fashioned sense of honor and conscience, and now he wants to make them permanent. This is the man who attacked the religious right as agents of intolerance and went and sought the endorsement of Reverend Hagee. And this is the man, and that for me was in a way the ultimate surrender, who voted against the bill that would have prevented the CIA from using torture. And this is a man who is a war hero, who has tortured himself for 5 years. So it's been really incredibly sad to see what happened. And at this very moment, when the right has been so discredited, he is their only hope, because he is, in a way, the Trojan horse of the right. And we Greeks know that Trojan horses are very dangerous things, because...
But Arianna, maybe he will get in there and revert to the old John McCain if he's elected.
Well, you know, I didn't even mention the main problem at the moment with John McCain, which is his position on Iraq. I mean, the way he's thinking of Iraq, his kind of ardor about this war, his delusional assessment of what has happened on the ground again and again. Remember when he went to that market in Baghdad and told us that things were returning to normal, forgetting to mention that he was surrounded by more soldiers than George Washington had at Valley Forge, and two helicopters overhead, and that on top of it, when he went back a few months ago, he couldn't even go to that place anymore. So the fact that he's so delusional about Iraq, for me, makes him like the kind of person you should not leave alone with sharp scissors, let alone put in the water.
All right. We'll return to that. But I want to ask Stuart. We're kind of going McCain, Obama, McCain, Obama. We're not going to do a lot of horse race stuff tonight, but I did want to ask you about Obama's problem with, I don't know how many of you saw the old John Sayles movie, Brother from Another Planet. Did you see that? And there is a problem, correct me if I'm wrong, that Obama has in representing for many Americans the other. It was just a focus group that the pollster Peter Hart conducted with 12 Pennsylvania voters, and four of them said that Obama wasn't American enough for them to vote for him for president. How big a hurdle is this for Obama?
Well, Jonathan, I think it is a problem to the extent that there are plenty of Americans out there, not necessarily out here, but out there, because most Americans right now are not in Aspen. I know that's hard to imagine, but... I think they have a hard time relating to him. He is a very different kind of politician. He looks different. He sounds different. I remember the first time I met Barack Obama. I'm a kind of a handicapper, particularly for House and Senate races, so I meet House and Senate candidates for about an hour, as if I worked for Merrill Lynch or UBS, but I'm not a pharmaceutical analyst or an automobile analyst. I'm a politician analyst. So they come for about an hour and we do the whole debrief them. And Barack Obama came to see me in October of 2002, 13 months after 9/11, more than 2 years, 2 years and 1 month before he was elected to the Senate. His fundraiser, Joe McClain, called me up, said, we got this candidate. You ought to meet him. He's great. He's interesting. He's smart. His name is Barack Obama. I said, what? Who's it? What's his name? This is 13 months after 9/11. Barack Obama. I said, oh, sure. Yeah, I'll be happy to meet him. Just bring him in. And I still remember that first meeting I had. He was smart. He was articulate. He was rather cool. He wasn't, a lot of guys come in and they're slapping you on the back and they're making jokes and they want to be friends. He was kind of distant. And I think some of that is what we still see. Now, that is different than the, oh, he's not an American. That's a kind of strange phenomenon that I can't entirely explain. But I think there is this question, there is this difficulty that some people have in relating to him. And maybe if they can't relate to him, they assume other things. Well, why can't I relate to him? It must be really different. And so I think he's going to have to get over this. As for the buzz on the internet, don't get me started on the internet, some of this stuff is just uncontrollable. But I don't think that's his fundamental problem. I think if he has a general election problem, and he has a lot of assets, but if he has a general election problem, it is more with kind of working class, white voters, older voters, and he just strikes them as kind of different. They can't relate to him. They don't know who he is. Maybe they think he's liberal. He's an African American. I think that's the bigger problem.
And do you think that he needs to go into a general election up by 5 points in the polls in order to win?
I think he needs to go up by a few percentage points in the poll. I don't know whether it's 2 or 3 or 5, but I think, what we say for front runners often is, we always say this for incumbents, but often for front runners, what you see is what you get. So if he goes in at 48, 46, he's probably in trouble. Now, people may be overstating his support. Right now, the huge advantage he has, I mean, we all know this, the huge advantage is he is better able to tap the desire for change. He is the purer change messenger on the basis of party, on the basis of what he looks like and his background and on the basis of his message. He is just it's easier for him to deliver that change message. And so I think that's how he does ride his way if he wins, and he has the advantage. That's how he rides it, and kind of being a little different turns out to be part of an asset. It's a liability, but it's an important asset.
Amy, is Barack Obama a sellout?
Well, I prefer to talk about movements than the candidates because, I mean, as I travel around the country speaking to people, you know, especially in this last week, I spent the weekend in Iowa and then Denver. And people were saying, well, what about the last week, right? You have the information coming out from Fortune where the whole controversy before where one of his advisors had gone into the Canadian embassy said, don't worry about his rhetoric against NAFTA. He'll really be fine with it. But now it turns out he says he really is fine with it. The Supreme Court decisions on overturning the gun law in Washington, Barack Obama being for it, the Supreme Court saying no to the death penalty for child rapists, him disagreeing with the conservative court. For many, we talked to Eleanor Holmes Norton. She was just completely shocked, saying, I thought he was opposed to the death penalty, let alone giving it to someone who has not killed someone. Then on campaign finance reform, you just sort of look at what's happened in the last week, and people are saying, what does this mean? I said, I think it means that when candidates come through to your area, you don't spend the time shaking their hand, but shake the system, make a demand. This isn't about these politicians. They are responding to pressures we see and a lot of forces that we don't see. But it's up to constituencies to determine what they will represent. That's what McCain and Obama are really about. And if they don't feel the pressure from other sides, they will respond. They will change every which way based on where they think people want them to be. That's what I think. And I think that this campaign is all about people being heard at the grassroots. There is a huge, rare opportunity right now where, first of all, I think people across the political spectrum actually are united. People who are opposed to war, people who are opposed to torture, are not a fringe minority, not a silent majority. They're the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media. But they're united. Conservative Republicans, progressives, Democrats, independents, Greens, people care about corporate control, they care about issues of privacy, and first and foremost, they care about war. Barack Obama changes each week. McCain changes. What is going to hold their feet to the fire is all of you, and not sitting back and being spectators. That is what's happening with these vast campaign rallies now. They do respond in this few moments, in these few months, and they respond to people who are organized and who carry a lot of weight by who you represent. It's an extremely rare moment, and I think we have to stop focusing on these individuals, and especially the corporate media, have to turn the mics around to not only all of you in this room in Aspen, but all over, because people are much more radical and angry across the political spectrum than these candidates represent.
Since we are focused on the candidates, are any of these recent trimmings, as they used to be called in American politics, by Obama deal breakers with the left, either the immunity provisions for the telcos, campaign finance reform, flip-flop, do any of them cut deeply enough, do you think, with this silenced majority to actually significantly dampen the enthusiasm for Obama?
I think Barack Obama has to be very careful about what happened to John Kerry. And that is, Kerry made a calculation, which Obama is clearly making, and that is people who would probably vote for him have absolutely nowhere else to go. And, of course, he'll just keep appealing to other groups of people that he thinks would less likely vote for him but possibly could if he changes his positions. They do have somewhere else to go, and that is stay home. And that's what happened. Now, there's a lot of discussion right now about people really being galvanized, and that's very important. But depending on where he decides to go, that is the huge difference will be for Obama, is whether he maintains the momentum. And if in each of these cases he turns around, there is a limit to what will excite people. But again, I don't really think it's about Obama and McCain. I think this has to be an issues-focused election, first and foremost issues of war and issue of torture and, of course, issues of race and poverty here at home. And that people have to, instead of continually saying, what does he think, what does he feel, what do you really believe he feels in his heart, make demands. That's what they feel in their heart. They are feeling what you want in large enough numbers.
Jonathan, you wrote a widely noticed column recently saying that Sam Nunn should absolutely not be Obama's running mate because of his position on gays in the military, I guess 15 years ago now, 16 years ago. At what point can somebody amend their position and pass muster on that issue, or should we hold him accountable and disqualify him on these grounds?
Well, let's make one thing clear. The headline on the op-ed piece said, "Don't ask Nunn," but nowhere in the piece did I say that Nunn absolutely should not be chosen. The column said, when Senator Obama is looking for a number two, there's one person he should look at with extreme caution, that being Sam Nunn. So I can understand why you would make that mistake and why Stuart would make that mistake in the column that he wrote. But, you know, I recognize fully why Sam Nunn's name keeps popping up every 4 years for the VP shortlist. He is, in the Democratic Party's ideal, he's an ideal number two. He is a moderate. He is an expert on foreign policy. His foreign policy credentials and armed services credentials are unparalleled. I know that's hyperbolic, but you get what I mean. But I think for gays and lesbians, his fight against allowing gays in the military was such a significant event that many of them, and I have heard from them, which prompted me to write the column, were saying to me, if Obama chooses this guy, I will either stay home, or many of them are saying that they'll vote for McCain. And that's the problem, and that's why I wrote this column, that Senator Obama already has a problem with blue-collar white voters, who he's going to need to win. He has a problem with Hispanic voters. And the last thing he needs to have is another piece of the Democratic Party voting bloc being angry with him and staying home, or I think probably more likely than not, voting for McCain. And the other reason why, it's not so much that Senator Nunn opposed allowing gays in the military. I mean, that's a policy decision, it's a policy issue, and I'm all for vigorous debate. Where gays and lesbians had a major problem with what Sam Nunn did was when he did that infamous tour of the submarine barracks. And that was meant, as I wrote in the piece, meant to raise the ick factor about homosexuals. And for a lot of gays and lesbians, that was an image and that was a tactic that was too difficult to take then and is certainly difficult to take now.
Could you explain the submarines?
Well, think about it. A submarine, close quarters, close sleeping quarters, and so you're trying to highlight, I guess for the general public back in 93, 94, the what it might be like for your son to be in close quarters with someone who may or may not be gay. Never mind that, you know, gays and lesbians in the military are serving their country. They are obviously disciplined, and they're trying to serve with honor. And why they aren't able to serve in the military openly, as they do in Israel and Great Britain and Australia, is beyond me. And I think that's something that gays across America are also, they're scratching their heads. What is the problem here?
Not that this would be a reason to select him, but Stuart, couldn't Nunn's position, which he's now reevaluating, by the way,
he said that after 15 years, it's appropriate to reevaluate the policy. No way. And when he was pressed on it, are you saying that you're changing your mind? He said, I'm not saying, I'm just saying after 15, 16 years, it might be time to take a look at it. That's not
that
a statement of position.
So that is his hat in the ring.
I saw it way too.
Yeah, but Stuart, I wanted to ask you, would it necessarily be a detriment to the ticket, or is it possible that some of those more conservative voters might actually like Obama a little bit more for picking somebody who was seen as being tough on the issue of gays in the military?
Well, I should say first that my column that Jonathan referenced, which responded to his column, was a more general response about now we had entered a period where various constituencies were now going to try to shoot down a variety of names. So I didn't just refer to Sam Nunn and the gay community. I also referred to Chuck Hagel and the pro-Israel community, and I referred to the pro-life community and Tom Ridge on the Republican side. So, you know, I think we have entered this period now. There's all this buzz. We don't have anything to talk about for vice presidents, and Chris Matthews has to somehow keep his show going.
We're not going to do that tonight.
But let me just respond. The difference I have with Amy and Jonathan, and I'm sure Ariana on this one, although she hasn't yet chimed in. Somehow I think we can expect that to happen. Is that I think this election will be won in Ohio, Nevada, Virginia, Colorado, maybe Florida, not the entire country. You people from New York and New Jersey are very nice people, but you just don't matter in the presidential race. And so I think, you know, as a handicapper, I try to do this very cold-bloodedly. It comes down to certain states in the Electoral College. Now, look, if it turns out to be a 58-42 presidential race, it could be. If you go back to 1980, the race was very close until the end. It blew open. It's possible that it's going to blow open. And if it blows open, the odds are it's not going to blow open for John McCain. If it blows open, the chances are it's going to blow open for Obama. But if it's close, I think the election is going to determine on these kinds of states, swing voters, suburban voters, white working class voters, Michigan I throw in terms of McCain's chances. So I understand, Amy, that you think the country should go in a certain direction. I don't do, at least my role is not to say which way the country should go. It's just to say what determines which way the country goes. And I think most Americans, frankly, are not very ideological. Now, some of you are ideological. This panel is more ideological than the country at large. The country is not against George Bush because he's too conservative. The country is against George Bush because he screwed up on the war. The economy is in bad shape. The administration responded poorly after Hurricane Katrina. Ideological people may say that's an ideological reaction on his part. That's his problem, that it's ideological. Some of us would say, no, he's not very good at what he does. That's why I tend to think a more kind of centrist. I mean, I think Obama's successful because he's largely giving a message of change, and that's a pretty good message. Change. People want change. His problem is when he gets details, and if he gives the details you want, I think he risks his standing in the race.
Ariana,
actually, if I may chime in, I actually just wrote yesterday a blog post where I pretended that I was a cold-blooded, calculating campaign manager for the Obama campaign who couldn't care less what his policies were, where the country was going, and simply was giving him advice based on absolutely nothing except winning.
That's why I said what I did. You were going to chime in on it.
So, and I could not more fully disagree with Stu's analysis. I think that if, purely on those grounds, forgetting at the moment what Amy and I believe in and what we want, where we want the country to go to, just purely Obama or McCain in the White House, what he's been doing in the last 2 weeks has been undercutting his brand in such a fundamental way that it's opening a huge vacuum where McCain can really fail. Because the majority of the public, still sees McCain as the maverick independent that I loved in 2000 and the media fell in love in 2000. And they haven't really been up to date on what has happened to John McCain, which is why you have the 28-48% disconnect. 28% approve of George Bush, about 48%, sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more, want to vote for John McCain. So that disconnect is really very troubling for Obama. And remember, his candidacy, as he keeps saying again and again, is an unlikely candidacy. And he is the Democratic nominee precisely because the country is longing for change and because Mark Pence so completely mismanaged the Hillary Clinton campaign. Because Mark Pence ran exactly the kind of campaign that Stu is now advising Obama to run. Appeal to the swing voters. Take care of those constituencies here and those constituencies there. Mark Pence wrote a book called Microtrends versus Megatrends. He's the master of microtrends. This election is about a megatrend. And I actually believe either Obama will win in a landslide or McCain will win. Because that's what's going to happen now. We're going to see such massive fear-mongering about the Obama candidacy. What Jonathan said watched yesterday, you know, the four Americans who do not think he's American enough. You see, the swing voters are the most fickle of voters. In 2004, 46% of swing voters actually believed the swift voting of John Kerry. They actually believed that John Kerry inflicted wounds on himself in order to get the Purple Heart. So you can make the swing voters believe anything. And if Obama wants to go into the election in November counting on the swing voters, he better think again. He needs to count on the unlikely voters. 83 million Americans did not vote in 2004. Obama has had an unprecedented success at registering new voters, getting young people out to vote. Why not run a different kind of election, a different kind of campaign? But most candidates cannot do that, but he can. And if he doesn't, he's not going to win.
But Ariana, is saying that the telephone companies should get immunity somehow betraying a bond to those
No, you see, you're misunderstanding what I'm saying. No. What I'm saying is that he said something completely different before, and he's going back on it without explaining what has changed. I'm all in favor of people changing their minds. God knows I did.
At least twice.
I changed my mind once, but I gave a full explanation as to why 12 years ago I changed my mind. So if he wanted to change his mind on the telecom immunity...
He explained why he said that he needed...
No, he said the conditions have changed. What conditions have changed?
What happened last August where, even though it expired, basically we were operating in an unconstitutional environment where the Fourth Amendment had been suspended. So he believed that restoring the FISA court was the priority and that you might have to swallow some provisions of that bill that he wouldn't have liked in order to restore the FISA court. He wasn't saying, I believe the telephone company should get immunity. He was saying he could accept the immunity as the price for getting a larger bill. Now, why is that an insufficient explanation?
But, Jonathan, if you go back to what he had said when he stood with Senators Feingold and Dodd and said we need the grassroots to stand up against telecom immunity and compare it to his equivocating, nuanced constitutional position, which reminded you of John Kerry's I voted for it before I voted against it, that's not a winning strategy. And if you then go on to his interview with Fortune magazine, which in a way for me was the most troubling thing of all. When Nina Easton asked him during this interview, you said that NAFTA was devastating. And he replied, well, during the campaign, your rhetoric gets overheated at times and amplified. Well, maybe he should just give us a sign when his rhetoric is overheated so we don't actually take him at his word. I mean, that is such a huge opening for McCain, and he's been using it. He said you can't trust him. He changes his mind. He's just another Paul. He's just another hack politician. Barack Obama cannot win as a hack politician. You know, it's over. Either he's going to win as an inspirational, galvanizing force who will bring people around to demand fundamental change, or he's going to follow the Mark Penn, Tom Daschle strategy. Tom Daschle is very influential in the Obama campaign. And go back to the 2002 Tom Daschle strategy. He remembers, too. He co-authored the defense authorization, the war authorization with George Bush. He urged his party to just not take a stand on the war because he said we'll just vote with the president, and then we'll go on and win the election in 2002 on the economy, and they lost.
David, I want to ask you on this pandering, flip-flopping question. Why is it that McCain doesn't seem to pay as much of a price? Look at something like the gas tax holiday, on which I was not the only one who flayed Hillary Clinton for this outrageous pander that they couldn't find a single economist, even ones who worked for her campaign, who thought it was a good idea. And John McCain has the same position and hasn't paid the slightest price for it in terms of his, maverick image. Why not?
I guess I disagree. I think he has paid a price. I think if you – well, speaking for myself, I've wrote very positively about both candidates, and I've been disappointed and disillusioned in the campaigns they've run, which I don't think is worthy of the people they are. And that's in both cases. Neither has really bucked the system in the way I think it is in their nature to buck the system. And to me, the question is, can each of them, if elected, actually turn the page in American politics and create a new style of politics? And for Obama, it's a very much an open question, as it is for McCain. Obama, I've too have been disappointed in what he's done the last few weeks. I think he could have gone out on the road with McCain with these town hall meetings. I think that would have been great. I think it would have detracted from a lot of the soundbite politics. I don't blame him totally for flip-flopping on campaign finance, but I think it did destroy the maverick new politics style. But the problem with Obama is that he's not very legislatively skilled. He is, to be frank, and I'm someone who's a great admirer of him personally, he is, to be frank, a mediocre senator. If you talk to Republicans who admired Hillary Clinton for her senatorial skills about Obama, they think he just doesn't have the skills. He's never done it. They would tell you stories, and Democrats would tell you stories, of immigration reform when McCain and Kennedy were getting together, really hammering out an incredibly complicated piece of legislation. Obama parachuted in at certain moments, tried to reopen issues that had already been settled, and then showed up for the press conferences. And so, but I point that out because you wonder, is he politically savvy enough to actually change politics? And so as the one silver lining I would give to this recent trend toward pure politics is that maybe he is politically savvy enough, although I am disappointed in it. Now, in the case of McCain, again, it's a question of teamwork. Politics is a team sport. And can McCain actually create a bipartisan team, which I think he would want to do? On the virtue side, every Tuesday the Senate has a meeting, Senate policy lunches. And the Senate leaders set up in front, and they give the senators, especially on the Republican side, the message of the week. And then they bring in some schlep pollster to tell them why the message of the week is a great message. And McCain will sit in the back of the room, he'll take the message of the week, he'll turn into a paper airplane and throw it up in the air and says, you know, another great winner you've got for us this week. He's sort of the class clown. And I admire that in that he is actually thinking. But can someone who is an individualist, can he create the sort of bipartisan coalition that would actually break the partisan gridlock?
And does he have the temperament to do that? That's what, you know, they describe Franklin Roosevelt as having second-class intellect, first-class temperament. And there have been some questions about McCain's temperament. If he rages at members of Congress as president the way he has as their colleague, he could have a problem getting his program through.
No, right? I often don't think that's the key issue. I think for both of them, passing legislation, actually getting stuff done, is really, really hard. Lyndon Johnson knew how to do it. Dick Darman actually knew how to do it. I think both these men, who are tremendous men, have weaknesses in this regard. For McCain, as I mentioned, it's the disorganization, and frankly, the lack of emotional affect and emotional intensity when it comes to domestic policy. For Obama, it is caution. He is a cautious person. He is essentially an establishmentarian person, Tom Daschle. And breaking out of the mold will require a lot of incautious behavior. And so as much as I admire these men, I have fears that their politics is actually going to change a lot.
Jim, could Barack Obama end up under-delivering on the level of change that he has promised and deliver incremental change when the nation wants more fundamental change?
I think none of us believe that the election will be settled by the view of swing voters in Ohio on the FISA court. I doubt if that's going to be the decisive factor. The most important poll, consistent over a lot of years now, is people's fundamental dissatisfaction with the direction America's going in. It's up to 80% now. It's been about 70% now for decades, a long time. Now, most people in America, outside country, really think politics is broken in America. Most people believe that. I don't think what Amy's saying, it's truly not ideological. The J.P. Morgan chair in the last session said, gee, we don't have an energy policy, we don't have a health care policy, we don't have an infrastructure policy, we don't have an education policy. Those are kind of bipartisan problems, you know? So I think change did win this election. The Republicans, I think, kind of stumbled on to their best candidate because John McCain is the only one in that group who I think could be a change candidate. He has it, he's shown it's in him in the past. You know, David's early columns on Obama talked about how this is a guy who listens to people on both sides of the aisle, which he does. I mean, the Harvard Law School Review, when he was head of that, he didn't win because all the white liberals wanted to show they were liberal by voting for a black guy. He won because the conservatives thought he'd listen to them, which he did. So Obama, if you will, could under-deliver in the way people are talking about if, in the end, he's not perceived as a change candidate. Now, Martin Luther King Jr. never endorsed a candidate, and he always wanted them to endorse the agenda of his movement. I don't endorse for the same reasons. We're trying to get them to endorse a movement for change. And the formula for change, Amy's right, it's never... Lyndon Johnson wasn't a civil rights leader until Martin King and Rosa Parks made him one. The formula for change is movements pushing on open doors. That's the formula. I think, you know, Barack Obama's appeal is not that he'll lead this from Washington, because he won't. As much as I think change is in his DNA, I know him well, and he does want to change things. But whoever our favorite is this year, they won't be able to change the big things in this country unless and until there are citizen movements pressing and pushing from the outside. And it's not just ideology. It's about the need for fundamental change. And I think Barack, if he loses his image of a change agent here, I think he could lose that energy and momentum, and then I think it could be a very close race, dangerous for him.
David.
I just wanted a quick dissent. Whenever I meet an academic who's serving in government, either a Clinton or Bush administration, I always ask them, what have you learned actually being in government you didn't know before? And the most common answer I get was given to me recently by a person who was taught at Johns Hopkins and now working in the State Department. He said, I used to think politics was about 50%, government was about 50% personality and relationships. Now I realize it's 98% personality and relationships. And I do think in the crucial issue for the presidency, especially with complicated issues like health care and energy policy, is the mental landscape of the leader and the ability to craft coalitions. And the movement can be there, and the movement has been there for health care change for a long time. But it actually is the mental landscape of the leader and the ability to do the nitty-gritty of legislative work.
But is it possible that we're entering a new era, and this is something that Obama talks about, where movement politics have the impetus of the internet behind them and the possibilities of fresh ways of mobilizing people for political activity might change that landscape. So the question I would have for everybody is, what would constitute real change? Again, trying to get past the horse race a little bit. If we looked to 18 months from now, what should either of these candidates have accomplished so that we could say, hey, at least one or two things really changed? Can we get a significant piece of health care legislation, significant piece of energy legislation, or will we have a situation where we're just back into the irons again and into what used to be called gridlock?
It's interesting. Henry Kissinger had defined leadership as creating a new consensus around what you believe in. And what is interesting now is that the public is ahead of the leadership here. The public has already defined a new center. What used to be called left-wing positions on health care, on bringing the troops home from Iraq, on doing something about global warming, on corporate responsibility, are now solidly mainstream, with 60 to 80% majorities. But no leader has yet defined that new center. And they continue to look at American politics in this completely obsolete way of right versus left, when the right is basically discredited and down to that 28% who still approve of George Bush. The left either has massively expanded, which I don't believe, or has now become the new center when it comes to these fundamental issues of our time. And this is really Obama's great opportunity to be the leader who defines the new center, galvanizes the people, that movement that Amy and Jim have talked about, and brings about fundamental change. Just one last thing. You know, Isaiah Berlin talked about people being either foxes or hedgehogs. Now, Obama has the potential to be a fox, you know, somebody with a unified vision. And this is exactly what the times demand. But he's surrounded by hedgehogs. Tom Daschle is a classic tech hedgehog. Mark Penn was a... I'm sorry, the exact opposite. I'm sorry, the exact opposite, yes. Fox is, you know, he's a classic... Obama can be a hedgehog, and he's surrounded by foxes. And that's really... That's the kind of... the problem with his campaign, and he needs to resolve it quickly, because if he loses the momentum, it will be harder to recapture it.
Jonathan, what is that truffle that, you know, he should be going for?
I think he
I think he should be going for climate change legislation. I think because of Lieberman-Warner, it didn't quite get there, but there's a bill there. Both he and McCain, well, either one, I should just say, sorry, either one should go immediately for a climate change bill. And I think whether it's climate change, health care, the economy, the nation is desperate for someone to tell them the truth and to tell them that we've got some serious problems and here's what we're going to do. It's going to be tough. We're going to have to sacrifice. We are all in this together. And since we already have the foundation for climate change legislation with Lieberman-Warner, and we're dealing with $4 a gallon gasoline now and might be dealing with $5 or $6 by then, the nation is ready for someone, the President of the United States, to say to him and her and their families, we've got a lot of work to do, and this is the start. We'll start with climate change, get that done, and try to move on to something else. I'm probably pie in the sky here.
Tell people a little bit what's in that legislation and why you think that in the midst of an economic crisis it would be palatable for people.
I know. That's why I say it's going to be really hard. Basically, as I'm sure all of you know, the Lieberman-Warner bill would set up a cap-and-trade system on the energy sector and the transportation sector, where companies that emit CO2 would have to buy allowances for every ton of CO2, or however they work it out, that they emit into the atmosphere. It's going to have major impact on the economy. The world is looking to us to make this move first, before it does something. When I say the world, I'm talking about China, India, Indonesia, who are nations that are emitting carbon much more. Their economies are growing, so they're emitting tons and tons of carbon beyond what we're doing today. Professor Holden, I'm getting his name wrong, but from Harvard, said today definitively that China has surpassed the United States as the largest emitter of carbon in the world, not per capita, because, as he said, there are more capitas in China than here. But so the Lieberman-Warner bill was supposed to be the United States' first attempt at showing leadership, both at home and abroad, on the climate change issue.
Okay, what I want to do before we open it up for all of you, I want rapid round to go down the row, setting aside Iraq, where he has stated clearly he will withdraw 2 brigades a month over the first 16 months of his presidency. And McCain has stated clearly that he will stay in for, depending on, you know, how you want to analyze the statement, either many years or 100 years. Setting aside Iraq, what should the new president lead with? Because that first initiative can set the tone for the rest of his presidency. So real quick, write down.
But Jonathan, I don't think you can set aside Iraq, because you're saying that Barack Obama is saying bring the troops home, and he's not. And that's an enormous problem. And he's got to say bring the troops home. And he can't replace them with the mercenaries like Blackwater, which, unfortunately, even Hillary Clinton, when she was getting very desperate, said she would start to ban groups like Blackwater in Iraq when Barack Obama wouldn't come out with that position. Barack Obama has not come out with a bring the troops home position, and I don't think we can set it aside and say what else.
His position is very clear. 16 months, 2 brigades a month.
He has not said withdraw the troops, end the war in Iraq, and bring them home. He is very clear on not being clear on that.
Well, I guess we just disagree. I mean, he said, Amy, he couldn't be clearer. His first month of his presidency, he will withdraw 2 brigades. His second month, he will withdraw 2 more brigades, so that over a course of 16 months, he will reduce us to a minimal, like, 5,000 troop presence to guard the embassy and do a few other things. So I don't understand where you're saying the ambiguity comes
from. He's voted for war funding, and he has continually voted for that all along the way, despite the fact that he took a good position before the war and Hillary Clinton voted for the war. They then voted together from then on all along the way in the Senate. He has not clearly said bring these troops home. And when I questioned him in New York about the mercenaries, about groups like Blackwater, he said there's no way we can ban them, we can stop the privatization of the military, because we need them, for example, to protect the largest embassy and compound in the world, which is in Iraq. I don't think he's taken a very clear anti-war position, because he only has McCain to go against, who says stay for 100 years.
Stuart, what do you think you should lead with?
Can I have 45 seconds
before
I answer your question? I want to answer the previous question real quickly. I think there's going to be change after November. And I think there's going to be change because the Democrats are going to have a good year in House and Senate races. They're going to win 3 to 5, maybe more Senate seats, 10, 12, maybe 15 House seats. And if it's Barack Obama, he's going to have big enough majorities and the mandate of an incoming president who always gets a good deal of leeway to do something big. And if it is McCain, I think if McCain wins, frankly, he's going to be back to being the old McCain. I think in 6 months there'll be calls for impeachment, and they'll be all coming from Republicans. Because I'm convinced that McCain just likes to be the maverick. And I am surprised that he has gone as far as he has recently in going back to towing a traditional Republican line. If he's president, he's going to reach out to Democrats. He's going to have to. They're going to be big Democratic majorities, and he's going to relish that. He's going to enjoy it. I would say the number one issue, I just look at the polls. I don't know anything, but the polls tell me it's the economy, that you guys think the economy is a big issue. So I think the number one thing for the next president is going to be a broad economic agenda, certainly including jobs.
Ariana, what's number one?
I actually think that number one should be Jim's agenda, the whole agenda of poverty in this country, the whole agenda of what John Edwards coined, as the two Americas. I mean, that is really what is happening. I mean, you don't, again, have to be a progressive to say that. We have, the head of J.P. Morgan today talking about the fact that they would be willing to end, the permanent tax cuts if it was going to help with health care, with education, with all the major, major parts of the agenda that have remained now taken care of. And so that is why this is kind of a moral imperative, and that's why this is not just about legislation. I mean, I understand what David has been saying, but ultimately, more important than how you get somewhere is where do you want to go? That is really my main problem with McCain. It's like that where he wants to go, whether it's Iraq or the domestic priorities is wrong. So before we look at who can achieve their objectives, what are their objectives? And I think the objective of doing something for this enormous amount of suffering in this country, that's another thing that I feel must be happening on this campaign trail. They are confronted again and again. There's a really interesting story in the New York Times on Sunday with people in pain, with people who are losing their homes, with people who can't pay for health care. All these are real lives, and these candidates are confronted with them on a daily basis. So that, for me, would be the overwhelming priority other than Iraq and bringing the troops home.
Jim?
Well, the realities on the poverty front are much more significant and growing than most people even imagine, with foreclosures, the economic changes, and food prices and gas prices. But globally, 3 billion people are living on $2 a day. That's the huge political fact of the world that affects everything else. And as Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, says, that world can neither be just nor secure. So you can't, and it's tied to global warming. It's tied to all the rest. I mean, there's a triangle. It's economic justice, the environment, and conflict. There's arrows going all directions. They're all fueling each other. But the basic thing here is there's not an issue. Go back to what David said. It's in Washington, it's a mindset and relationships where it's the politics of fear and the politics of blame. That's the habit. Both sides do it. Around the country, I feel a real hunger for a politics of solutions and a politics of hope, but there's almost no leadership for that. So the question for us is, progressives in this crowd probably is mostly that, make the mistake of saying if your favorite wins, you kind of sit back and you say, well, let's see how he'll perform. If your favorite wins, you better start saying, okay, now it's time for us to perform. And until that changes, that mindset about citizenship, it begins with voting, but there's going to have to be a whole different mindset about forcing politics to deal with the real issues facing many Americans and half the world's population. That, I think, is the foundation.
So that's what "we are the ones we've been waiting for" means?
Well, he stole that from me, actually.
Probably.
But I believe it. Yeah. I believe it.
I just know that if Obama wins, the first thing they're going to do, I don't know what they expect to do, is two quick things to show they're different, which is S-CHIP and stem cell research. But beyond that, the first year, I think, will be healthcare, because it is the foundational. Aside from the economy, it is the one issue that comes up in town meeting after town meeting, and it is the foundational issue around which one can actually change politics, okay, if they do that.
Great. We have about 15 minutes. We decided we would go 90 minutes in this session for questions. And there are microphones in various parts of the hall, and we can...
Oh, okay, thanks.
Yes.
It's a little off subject, but can this administration get away with attacking Iran? And then what would that leave McCain and Obama with coming into?
Anybody want to try to tackle whether Dick Cheney might have his fondest wish fulfilled before they leave office?
Well, I guess I'll say even more than Ariana, I actually interview the president from time to time. And as my reading of his body language is that there's no interest, no plans, no willingness to bomb Iran, and he said things off the record which lead me to firmly believe we will not bomb Iran.
No, that's best news I've heard all night.
I
have to leave immediately to go blog this on the Huffington Post. I'll be right back.
I've said it on TV, so you can.
Yeah. Mr. Brooks, a lot of us read your column a few Fridays ago in which you described two Obamas, philosophical and politically practical, let's put it that way. And you also talked a great deal about truth, all of you. What was your reaction, Mr. Brooks, to the reaction of the Obama campaign to General Clark's truthful statement that heroism is not ipso facto a qualification to be president?
I'm not sure that's what Wesley Clark was saying. I thought what Clark did was, at least I only read the one sentence. What John McCain went through was extremely heroic, and I think Obama has phrased his criticisms of McCain carefully and intelligently. And I don't think in that regard his admirations for McCain's personal conduct is in any way political or insincere. My larger point in that column is, and this is crucial about Obama, he and I lived, some of us lived in Hyde Park. He's 7 days older than me, so I'll be younger than the next president. But we lived in Hyde Park at the same time during the rise of a politician called Harold Washington, who was the first black mayor of Chicago and an outstanding mayor. And Obama talks about Washington a lot. He had Washington's picture on his law school office at U of C, and Washington was a machine politician. He was not an activist. And when I read and have heard Obama talk about his admiration from Harold Washington, he's saying, I'm not purely an activist. I'm someone who is a machine professional politician in addition to the ideals I hold. And I think that's important to who Obama is, and I think that's why he has been so political.
I have to correct you on that a little bit as a native of Chicago who lived there and took part in Chicago politics for quite a long time. He started out as a machine politician, and then became an activist.
No, well, this is the conversation I've had. Yeah. He was an activist. But
the conversation I've had, there were two leaders on the night Washington won the mayoralty. There were two leaders who spoke. There was Jackson and Harold Washington. They were two extremely different casts of mind. Jackson did, he was who Jackson is. But Washington was a very different, pragmatic cast of mind. That doesn't mean he was Daily Machine or anything like that, but it was a very different cast of mind. And I think Obama's political nature and his cautious nature and seeing himself as a pragmatic politician very different.
Politics is the art of the possible. But just I think any Chicagoans in the audience, and the Aspen Institute was founded by Chicagoans, know that Harold Washington wasn't what we would describe as a machine politician, because he was never after his early days close to the
Daily. Okay, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
Just a minor point. Next. Yes.
Got one? Yeah, thank you for that elegant punditry. I think we owe you a round of applause. I have a simple question. It's been said that every one of these first-year efforts that you are suggesting for the president, every one of them is hugely, hugely difficult. Global warming is going to increase costs, health care, bucket of worms, et cetera, et cetera. I've also been told that probably this will be a one-term presidency for whoever gets it. My question is, why would anyone want this job?
I think maybe we can leave that as a comment rather than a question. Yeah.
Could the panelists please say whether the vice presidential pick matters and who they think might be each candidate's running
mate? It would be great if everybody quickly answered that question, but I'd like to amend it a little bit because the truth is that none of us know, and if we pretend we know who it's going to be, we're blowing smoke. Obama and McCain probably don't know themselves. But I'd be happy to have the panel answer that question, or try to. But also, if you could, answer the question, who would be the best vice president? Since I think tonight we've done a good job of getting out of the usual horse race stuff to this question of how he would govern, which is the central issue. Who would be the best vice president for each to have a successful presidency, and also who, as the question asked, would be the most likely nominee? Why don't we start on this side with Jonathan? Sorry.
Oh, great.
We don't want none. So
well, I think no, that's just the headline.
Right, I'm sorry.
I do think, as a result of Vice President Cheney, the vice presidency is incredibly important. I think because of Senator McCain's age, I think a lot of people will look to who he chooses as his vice president as someone they could envision. They will with Obama's pick, but it's probably more, they would view it more importantly for McCain's pick as someone who they feel comfortable sitting in the Oval Office. Personally, I think for Senator Obama, because the economy is first and foremost right now in the American people's minds, I think he should look at someone who has a governor who has had to deal with balancing budgets in states with constrained tax revenue, someone who could appeal to blue-collar white voters who he could not reach in the final months of the campaign against Senator Clinton. I think for Senator McCain, because he's viewed as he's a foreign policy expert. He talks about foreign policy all the time, about Iraq all the time. I think he should have somebody also who can focus domestically. So basically the bottom line is, I think, and you guys could disagree with me, either one should pick a governor and a governor who people can envision being president of the United States.
And could you just very quickly throw out a couple names for people?
But you just said if we like we'd be blowing smoke.
No, I'm talking about who would be good, not who he's likely to pick.
Okay.
But who would actually be good in the job, which is a question that doesn't get asked very often.
I think on the Democratic side, Ed Rendell, Pennsylvania. I would have said Strickland, but he took himself out of it. And for McCain, I'm not quite sure, but for some reason I keep thinking of Huckabee. But I think for both of them, they'd be very smart. And from what I understand, they're both doing this. Look at Mike Bloomberg.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that since you... Bloomberg. Okay. Now, I know, Amy, you don't like to focus on the candidates, but you might have to deal with this vice presidential character. If history is any lesson, since half of the vice presidents since World War II have become president, who would you feel most or least uncomfortable with, let's put it that way, in the job?
I just think that I think the reason people are gathered here, and the reason I resist answering that question, is that people deeply care about what's happening in this country. And unfortunately, television very much focuses on individuals. And I think people get increasingly alienated because it's all about the horse rates, the percentages, the names of the people, and not what people can do.
I'm stipulating that this is not about the horse race. I want to know the kind of person you could live with in power who's out there on the political scene right now. Now, we know you could probably live with Barack Obama. Who else? Because these vice presidents now are worth more than a bucket of worm spit.
But you know, I think the
individuals count, don't they?
I think that is really on television. It seems to be almost the only discussion that's had, and it's not about the issues. And so people go away feeling a bit paralyzed. Who is the one person I can think of, or the second person who can save this country? We talk about the president being the first, and it's not them. And that's why I resist the conversation. I appreciate why you're asking it. But I think it is so important. You're taking for granted that people know they should just go out and do something.
Yeah.
I think people are very trained by television to resist, to sit back. And that is not the discussion we should have. It should be a person who is strongly, fiercely opposed to war, fiercely opposed to torture, for health insurance for everyone, and that is only going to come not from an individual who will be shot down immediately, but from people making these demands and not sitting back.
Well, all that I'm saying is that, you know, if Albert Ritchie, not Franklin Roosevelt, had been nominated in 1932, we'd be living in a different country. So the individuals do matter. Stuart.
Okay, I have no idea who's going to be picked, so I'll give you people who I think both would be assets politically, but more so who I think would be good vice presidents, is what you suggested. On the Democratic side, I'll give you two names, Joe Biden and Evan Bayh, senators of Delaware and Indiana. And for McCain, it's Lieberman.
Arianna, who would you be least uncomfortable with in the job?
Actually, I think individuals matter tremendously, especially at this moment when a leader can redefine where we are. And I would, if I were Barack Obama, I would make a really unconventional choice. I would pick a hedgehog who agreed with me on the biggest issue of our time, which is Iraq, who has been brave and courageous and eloquent and consistent in his opposition to the administration. I would pick Senator Chuck Hagel.
And the fact that he's not pro-choice wouldn't be...
I think that the most important thing, Obama would be there. He would be the one picking the nominees for the Supreme Court. I think the message that this would send about the priority that he would be putting on the war, the bravery of Chuck Hagel has been amazing on this issue. You know, but in a way, he's been braver than many Democrats who are opposed to the war, ostensibly. In terms of McCain, I would actually pick Governor Polanyi from Minnesota because of his whole working class appeal, you know, the Sam's Club, the relative youth and inexperience.
Jim?
I was actually going to suggest Hagel as well for Obama. The other possibilities there are, I think he should probably pick somebody who exemplifies his vision of things more than just a state that he needs. So we all know who's on the usual list. But two people that I think do that, one is a governor of a state that he needs. I think Tim Kaine's an interesting politician and an interesting choice, governor of Virginia. And I would love to see Barack pick John Edwards to be his... Doesn't bring a state, but it brings a kind of a vision of things, of new politics, that would, I think, be complementary. I know for a fact that a lot of the conservatives that I talk to on a regular basis desperately hope McCain picks a younger person who is more orthodox in conservative politics, probably Pawlenty or watch for Governor Sanford of South Carolina.
David?
My throwaway line is that Obama should pick an old white general, so he should pick Dwight Eisenhower. And McCain needs someone younger than himself, so he should also pick Dwight Eisenhower. My actual thought is that you don't pick on the states, you pick on the president. At some point in the administration, is going to have to make a terrible decision. And he's going to be in the cabinet room. He's going to have to look across the table or look directly at the vice president in the eye and want that person and know that person will be with him no matter what decision is made. And so you're marrying someone, so pick someone you really get along with and who can serve you in ways you need service. And that is, I wasn't going to go there. I think for Barack Obama, I think Joe Biden would be a very good choice. Ariane, I also think Tom Daschle would be a good choice. I talked about the difficulty of getting things done. This cap and trade bill in the Senate, it got essentially 40 votes of support. That's going to be very hard to pass. You need somebody like Biden or Daschle knows how to get things done. McCain, I've been harping on the fact that he's not the most organized guy in the world. Rob Portman was a multi-term congressman from Ohio, ran the budget office, ran the trade office, a very organized, domestic policy-oriented guy, and I think he'd be best for McCain.
Well, rather than ending on Rob Portman, I'd like to end on Ike, and who helped give the 1960 election to John Kennedy by when he was asked what Richard Nixon had contributed to his administration. He said, "Give me a week and I'll think of something." So that is also an indication that happened late in that campaign. That's an indication of how many variables are still at play, how much time there is to go. And so not only is the outcome of the election still very much in question, but these questions of what kind of a country we'll be living in next year are wonderful to ponder, and I think that we did a good job tonight with the panel in doing so. So thank you very much.